Episode 11. American History. EFT. That's an abbreviation, by the way. Critical thinking question. How does something completely irrational and completely immoral transform into what is completely acceptable? Even what is completely preferable? Even what is, believe it or not, unquestionably sacred? Believe it or not, I actually have some pretty fond memories of my experience as a high school history student. I remember this one class in particular. I was probably either a sophomore or a junior. The classroom was situated in a way that I think most people would be very familiar with. The desks were organized in rows, 7 or 8 deep, and in columns, 5 or 6 across the front of the room. Each day in class, that I can recall anyway, we would all sit in our desks with our textbooks open, and one by one we would take turns reading a paragraph out of the book, up one row and down the next. My positive memories of this experience had absolutely nothing to do with history or with the teacher. It was during this time that I was able to complete some of my finest illustrations of exotic automobiles and baseball stadiums, perhaps in my entire high school career. The teacher never left her desk, and this way she wouldn't wander around and interfere with the drawings that I enjoyed so much while my peers were reading. When the student at the beginning of my row began to read, that was my cue that I quickly had to scramble to find my place in the book. So when it came to be my turn, I would know the paragraph to read, I wouldn't draw any attention to myself, and then I could go back to doing my drawings. If somebody asked me to recount the sum total of my experience as a high school history student, this is pretty much all I could tell them. Strangely enough, if somebody asked me to recount the sum total of my elementary school history experience, I would have much more of a story to tell. You see, elementary school history had heroic and special people. A noble leader who rose up from humble beginnings in a log cabin and single-handedly freed an entire race of people. A noble leader who, as a boy, was so gosh darn honest that when he hacked down his father's cherry tree, he was compelled to tell him the truth about it. Of course, setting the precedent for all of the people who would follow him. Like the log cabin guy, who came later, but was also known for his honesty. And how can we forget the wonderful story of the brave sailor who defied conventional wisdom that the planet was flat and bravely sailed to a new world, which he discovered and settled. These are the stories that I remember from elementary school. There are no factoids or mundane details or dates or terms to remember. Just wonderful stories. But something happens to history when we get a little bit older. Stories aren't so exciting anymore. There's more names, there's more dates, there's more details. And we have a tendency as teenagers to tune that out. The result of this, for too many people, is when we graduate from high school, most of our memories about the nation's history are from the first 6 years, the clearest ones anyway, when these wonderful, emotion-driven stories about heroes were told to us. These first 6 years of school, incidentally, coincide with a time in our life when Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and a magical fairy, who for some reason wants to purchase from you your baby teeth, also seem like plausible ideas. It seems that when we're young, those who want to impose certain beliefs on us will take advantage of one of our greatest gifts. But strangely enough, they will also later destroy our imagination. But this is how mythology and mysticism work. This is how they are perpetuated. You have to get people when they are young. Imagine this for a moment. Let's say you're 30 years old and you've lived your entire life as an atheist. No pollution of mythology or religious mysticism whatsoever. You have a moral philosophy that's based on reason. You embrace empiricism and the scientific method. You require evidence for all that you believe. Somebody approaches you on the street to share with you the story of the Christian Bible. First, you learn that there is an invisible but magical and all-powerful being that 6,000 years ago made the earth in 3 days. So that's 72 hours for a rock in space 7,000 miles across. In the very next day, in the next 24 hours, he made the rest of the universe. And there's no details about maybe he was forced to use union labor on Earth, which is what slowed the project down. But we just accept this. And the story even gets better. He makes the first man apparently out of thin air and then fashions the first woman out of this man's rib. And then the woman goes and takes some advice from an evil talking snake, and she eats a magical piece of fruit and releases all evil in the world. And because of that, we are all evil. And the story goes on, and that's like the introduction. That's just kind of setting the tone. That reminds me of a joke, incidentally. God comes to Adam and says, look, you seem to be lonely here. Let me make you an offer. I will produce for you a partner that you can have a family with that will keep you company. And most importantly, she will have the foresight to not take advice from talking snakes and release all evil into the world. So that sounds like a pretty good deal. So Adam says, oh, yeah, that does sound pretty good. What's that going to cost me? And God says, one of your arms and one of your legs. And I know that sounds a little steep, Adam, but what you're really paying for is the resistance to the charm and persuasiveness of talking snakes. And you're going to want that. And Adam says, well, what could I get for, like, a rib? The Christian teacher that you've encountered could go on and on for hours with their story. Days, probably, if you let them. But as somebody who had lived their entire adult life as a rational human being, after listening to them for a couple of minutes at most, you would probably want to put a helmet on this person and do everything you can to make sure they don't suddenly dart out into traffic. But if you were just a little 5 or 6 year old boy or girl, and this person approached you to tell you this fantastic story, you would be much more likely to believe them. And even more likely if this was a person of importance to you or a person of authority. And they kind of gave you the subtle idea that their love or their approval or their satisfaction with you was somewhat dependent on your willingness to accept what they were telling you. This happens at home. This happens at school. And like I said, this is how mysticism and mythology get perpetuated. These are ideas that can only sink their fangs, for the most part, into the minds of impressionable children. And of course, I'm not suggesting that children are somehow foolish. It's just that when we're young, the reverence we tend to have for adults makes us easy targets for this kind of mysticism. Statism, a widely held belief that certain people have a magical power that allows them to use violence and threats for some kind of noble purpose, is a form of mysticism. Patriotism and nationalism are forms of mysticism. And if you are one of these mystics, you become especially dangerous when you gain control over an institution that takes a child and keeps them a child long after nature tells them that they are no longer a child. You can keep reinforcing this mysticism with whatever retarded, nonsensical, and acausal stories you like, probably for about a decade before you finally let them go out into the world crippled by irrational beliefs. For me, this happened in 1995 when I graduated from high school and moved to the next station for the perpetuation of mysticism and popular and socially acceptable ideologies, college. For my major, there were two history classes that were required as core curriculum. I don't think it mattered what they were, you just had to take two of them. The college was small enough that I knew that I was going to get stuck with this certain professor who had a reputation for being extremely difficult. His classes were known to be very challenging. And as a 19-year-old child, I had decided that finding money to buy alcohol was all the challenges that my life had room for at the time. Of course, too, I also hated history as I reflected back on how boring the subject had been in high school. But in my sophomore year, I finally had to enroll in one of this professor's classes. I immediately, somehow, fell in love with history, and I believe it had a lot to do with the teacher who I would say to this day is still the best teacher I can ever remember having, by far, by miles. He quickly shattered my illusions that people like Christopher Columbus were heroes. But what made him a good teacher had a lot more to do with his style than with his message. I remember graduating from college thinking that people like Lyndon Johnson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt were heroes. I suddenly had this strong interest in this sort of social justice that I had come to believe could be delivered by bureaucrats and brave politicians who also have the ability to fix the economy after a crisis while delivering equality to the huddled masses who had been trapped for so long under the thumb of greedy, evil, capitalist businessmen. It's a beautiful, beautiful picture. So 4 years later, I had found a new love for history, for sure, but my understanding of it had changed very little since the first grade. But now, at age 21, my greatest ambition was to become a history teacher at the secondary level, ultimately in public school, which is where I thought real teaching happened. But right out of college, I decided that my best shot was at a private residential boarding school for troubled children. When I started to teach history, I quickly realized that, these kids hate history as much as I did when I was their age. I had a sort of special difficulty with inner city kids. The school brought kids in from some of the worst neighborhoods in the worst places in the eastern United States, the outer boroughs of New York City, East Providence, Rhode Island, Baltimore, Maryland, and the ghettos around Washington, D.C. These kids from the inner city, who were mostly black and Hispanic, had attended inner city government schools. They had had far more interactions with the police and the justice system than I had had, even though I was 5 or 6 years their senior. They had found themselves, for one reason or another, in state custody with the state or some bureaucrat as their guardian. And many of them lived in what we will call planned communities. They were not going to be conned by my pedagogy of good government for a second. At the time, I interpreted this as resistance, as defiance. What I didn't realize then, but I do realize now, is that they were trying to teach me something about the state. The subtext of these confrontations was that there was no way that some 20-something upper-middle-class kid from New Hampshire knew nearly as much about the realities of government as a 16-year-old in their situation did. And they were right. Now, at this time in my career, I will say that I was heavily influenced by the writings of people like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky. And I felt like I was doing a really good job of bravely tackling subjects and issues that were swept under the rug in public school. The systematic mass murder of Native Americans who stood in the way of manifest destiny, racial injustice, in slavery, the treatment of the poor. I thought I was doing all the right things, but I realized later that even this because of the way I was doing it, was a disservice to the students I was teaching. It was pointed out to me one day by a young man from East Providence who said something like, you know, you're pretty good at talking about all of this injustice that's been imposed upon black people and poor people. But your stories always seem to come to this nice and neat ending when some rich white guy rides in on a horse to save the day. At the time, I probably interpreted it as just another one of the racially charged statements that were so common at this school that I taught at. But later, I think I got a clearer understanding of what he was trying to say and who he was talking about. He was talking about the politicians, the people who, through our public school and college history classes, are the heroes and the visionaries. They are always the problem solvers. Lincoln freed the African American people from enslavement. And 100 years later, Lyndon Johnson gave them civil rights. Every story comes to a nice and neat, happy ending, courtesy of the state, the institution that we are trained to worship. And after this great discovery that I had made in college, that I actually loved history, that I wanted to learn everything that I possibly could about history, that I had this renewed desire for inquiry, something that I probably hadn't experienced since I was a little kid. Why was my mind still so full of this public school poison? From the writings of Joseph Chomsky and Zinn, I had learned that this organization, the U.S. government, and just for the sake of brevity, I'll limit this to the 20th century alone, had murdered 500,000 people in the Philippines during an imperialist invasion of that country, had spent most of the 19-teens terrorizing various countries in Central and Latin America while racially segregating their own executive offices. They had repressed women. They had jailed their own citizens during wartime for dissent. In the next war, they put their own citizens in concentration camps and then ended that war by exterminating, vaporizing over 100,000 innocent Japanese people in 1 week. Decades later, they moved to Southeast Asia, where they killed millions in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Back home, individuals within this organization were enacting systemic violence against those they perceived as being the more disobedient members of the civil rights movement. They would revive this violence against those who dared to protest the institutionalized mass murder that was being called the Vietnam War. And that's the short list. Now, why was I still holding on to the idea that such an organization was capable of doing good, or that such an organization was even legitimate, or that the kinds of individuals equipped with the claws necessary to climb into such an organization would ever use its violent power for something just? All the people in the organization changed. The administrations, the people in charge of departments. But no matter who they were, or where they were, or when they were, they all seemed to be following the same basic ethical framework, which, to anyone paying attention, would speak volumes about the nature of the organization and the nature of the individuals that such an organization attracts. But here I was at the front of this classroom, and at this time in my career, I think, if I remember correctly, I had even become aware of people like Gatto. And here I was, encouraging my students to believe that this organization could somehow do good. How was I able to maintain such an irrational and contradictory belief? Now, unfortunately, at this early point in my career, I wasn't asking myself any of these questions. You see, my primary concern at the time, I told you about this student who questioned the way I taught and otherwise didn't really seem very interested in anything I was saying. So I wanted to know, why were my kids so apathetic? Why didn't they care about how we had come to arrive at this point in history? Why did they not care about the story behind the world that they were inheriting? I mentioned before that the history curriculum that we deal with in public education seems to have a great emotional impact on us when we are most impressionable. And isn't that just simply one of the greatest tricks of indoctrination and management of public opinion? You train people to think about things emotionally, pretty much as a guarantee that they will never be able to think about them logically. In school, we are trained to think about the government, which somehow becomes synonymous with the country, which somehow becomes synonymous with us in an emotional way. As adults, this shows up either as some sort of nostalgic or nationalistic pride, or as the most powerful emotional tool of all for those in power, fear. We are not to think about what is going on in a logical way. That is the curriculum of elementary school. What follows is 6 or 7 years of learning that history is actually a waste of time because it's boring and repetitive. If I was to describe the secondary history curriculum, or more importantly, the secondary history textbooks, as 500 or 600 pages of bland apologia in favor of state power, I would probably be telling you something that you already knew. And if I was to describe the highly political textbook adoption process state by state, I would be boring you. Of course, that is something of interest. Textbook publishers have even gone as far to write special editions for states to ensure that they make it through the adoption process, like Scott Forstman's Lone Star edition of one of their American history texts. Now, of course, the textbooks are important because for many teachers, they're providing a guideline or a framework for the way they teach. Earlier in my career, I, of course, was guilty of this as well. As one student pointed out to me, a poor minority from the inner city who was kind of shocked at the way that I could invent happy endings to stories about poor people and about Black and Hispanic people. But when I started to look a little bit closer at the textbooks, I realized that they were even better at this than I was. Figured out where I had learned it too. The history texts are also not cumulative in the same way that other textbooks, like in math and science and even English, are, where you have to have a solid understanding of one concept before you can go on to the next because it's built on top of that concept. In history, all the causality is removed. The stories exist as just connectionless factoids to learn and then to repeat back on a test. Causality is stripped out entirely. No one can understand why anything happened, which is why things today like the economic crisis, the healthcare situation, and the wars in the Middle East create such confusion for people. It's also why so many can rationalize the United States' involvement in the First and Second World War, and even rationalize the horror of dropping the atomic bomb on civilians in Japan to end that war. Politicians and those who hold power and the apologists for those people in places like the mainstream media seem to understand this problem that most people have due to the lack of real education. When the actual answers to questions or the actual explanations behind pressing problems are too complex, they can just invent easy answers. The formula that is used here is so simplistic that people should be embarrassed if they don't realize it. If a politician's goal is more regulation, then they say the problem, whatever the problem they're dealing with, stems entirely from a lack of regulation. And of course, in the last presidential administration, the neoconservative intellectuals who hid in the shadows of George Bush's cowboy hat and chainsaw, who had also been basically pleasuring themselves to the thought of expanding U.S. hegemony in the Middle East, after 9/11 claimed that it was a problem that stemmed from not having enough of a presence in that region, when it was actually the opposite that was true. They know that they're probably not going to be fact-checked. Well, now they are. But even like in 2002 or 2003, I remember George Bush thinking he could get away with this when on the eve of the invasion of Iraq, he uttered something to the effect of the U.S. Army has never been used for any other purpose than liberation, which is astonishing. The Christian street preacher that I spoke about earlier in this episode is a symptom of the same problem. When you don't understand how something could have happened or the complexity behind a chain of events leading up to the present day, you just invent an answer, like Christianity. Now, in these textbooks, the narrative is, of course, incredibly well filtered. Anything that's even somewhat controversial is best removed, because including controversial material would lead to the books not being adopted by the committees of bureaucrats in each state who get to make that decision. But even the chronology is tinkered with in a way that's kind of alarming. Most American history classes wrap up somewhere around 1950 or 1960. And I guess what these nationalistic writers and textbook adoption committees have decided is that the boys coming home in victory from World War II to ticker tape parades is a much happier ending than, say, the upheaval in the South in the mid and late 1960s over civil rights or the Vietnam War. Those are not happy endings. So sometimes certain aspects of reality are just eliminated from the timeline because they're inconvenient. The result of teaching history this way is tragic. I mean, history is a bunch of stories that sometimes exist in conflict, sometimes they weave together. It creates a tremendous amount of opportunity for inquiry, for debate. There's uncertainty, there's questions. It's such a good opportunity for real learning to take place. But in public school, that opportunity, as the title of this episode suggests, is destroyed. It's absolutely ruined by the presentation of history, especially in secondary schools, right? And just in the event that some students are paying attention, like I said, the stories are so well filtered that they're not really going to learn anything important anyway. Either way, students accept this version of history as the full picture of history. Why wouldn't it be full? When you don't know these stories, you look at this textbook or you listen to your teacher, they have this authoritative, all-knowing voice that suggests this is it, right? Like the other books where we don't know too much about the subjects, biology, chemistry, trigonometry. We wouldn't think to ourselves as we're in those class learning those subjects that there's a whole other realm of information beyond what's in the book. If this is something you need to know, it's going to be in the book. And I think a lot of people tend to apply that same misunderstanding to the history textbooks. I guess the message that most people would take away from a 12-year public education with respect to history would be that the United States is a special place led by special people and has a special mission to do good in the world. So why worry about all the little details, especially when there's this great sense of pride and belonging that you can focus on instead? And if we are part of the exclusive group that has some kind of history class after high school, it's one out of every six people who will do this, we learn that when something does go wrong in this wonderful place, politicians, elected leaders, the powerful, the intellectuals will know how to solve it. So we put our trust in them, or if we're really concerned with public policy, we work to be a part of that group. In the later years of high school, students in honors level or advanced placement history classes get a similar message, since they've been categorized as potential leaders. History, too, is written by the people who win the wars, by the most powerful and the most violent. It's strange, perhaps even troubling, to think about how most people are so willing to side with their oppressors, to rationalize what they do, and to offer apologies for their behavior. But when we look at the way that history is taught to us, we see that these rationalizations, that this siding with the oppressors, starts to make a lot more sense. When in these books and in our history classes, we are given invitation after invitation to do exactly that. When you combine the sum of these parts with this history curriculum, with the other curriculum that I had been talking about for the last several episodes, the result would be a message like, you as an individual are nothing. You are essentially valueless. But if you behave appropriately, you will get to be a part of a shining community on a hill. You will get to live in the best place on earth. You'll get to be part of the best culture with the richest heritage, a gift that you inherit from brave and noble leaders with incredible vision and foresight, a gift that is maintained by brave and noble leaders who deserve your reverence, your support, and your trust. I sincerely hope that Americans are the last people who are ever taught this reductive, nonsensical, and confusing version of their history. But as I've mentioned before, they were not the first. Now, I'll save that topic for next time, but perhaps just to preview it a little bit. In today's show notes, I put a picture of Edward Norton's character, Derek, from the film American History X, just to make sure that everybody knew that the title of this episode was a play on that title. But I also think that there's something else going on in this picture that's worth talking about for a minute. Just to keep it brief, Norton's character is a white supremacist who undergoes a pretty significant catharsis during the course of the film. The picture is from a point in the film after this transformation has occurred, after these realizations have become so clear. And as he's stepping out of the shower, he catches a glimpse of himself in the mirror. And the look on his face is almost one of shock, like he, for a moment, forgot who he used to be and was reminded of who he used to be by what he saw. The look on his face is one of disappointment and disgust with himself as he remembers that he has this large black tattoo of a swastika on his chest, this symbol of extreme bigotry, extreme nationalism, and extreme mysticism, and a complete vacuum of decency or empathy. Now, in this scene in the film, I think that the viewer is perhaps encouraged to feel bad for Derek. But it kind of begs the question, is a belief system like that such an immoral and irrational belief system? An easier thing to confront and eventually expunge when it is also branded on the outside. So we've certainly skimmed across the surface of a lot of potential topics. This episode was intended as an introduction to a series of several episodes where we will continue to talk about how history works in our public schools, the messages that it includes, and how that creates this illusion of the state as an acceptable thing and as a preferable thing, and of course even as a sacred thing for some people when you wrap up all that sort of nationalistic symbolism with it. And in closing today, I just wanted to extend a thanks to a couple of people. Marcige, who I mentioned last time, who's continued to do some graphic stuff for us. John, who offered to take the 30-second promos that I recorded for the show and turn them into YouTube videos, and Scott, who is going to work on some flyers and some literature to hand out related to the show as well. That is all greatly appreciated. And, of course, to Jason Osborne, the Free Talk Live advertising campaign that he put together has been absolutely huge, and his continuous support of the show is greatly appreciated. As a matter of fact, I will certainly, as we're getting ready to move to this new website and have some new content, I will find a way to make sure that everybody who has helped out the show with money or ideas or in any other way gets the recognition that they deserve, because there's quite a few people. So anyway, until next time, thank you so much for listening, and take care.